move to the third, or the next case, actually, the next case is one we're taking.
Under advice.
If I can turn the page. Yeah, the fourth case is where the argument has been waived, and we'll take them on the briefs. So we'll move to the fifth case, which is United States versus Salvador Castro Juarez. Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Your Honor. Yes, mm-hmm. Steve Williams for the defendant. May it please the court. Mr. Garrison. The gist of the defendant appellant's argument here, Your Honor, is simply, or Your Honor, is that 48 months is simply too severe of a sentence in light of all the factors that are enumerated under Section 3553A and with reference to the guidelines sentence that was advisory but specified 15 to 20 months as an advisory guideline range. And in this particular case, Mr. Castro Juarez received a sentence that was more than double the high end of the range. It represented what would have been, under guidelines parlance, an upward departure of 7 levels or an upward departure of 20 criminal history points.
Isn't it 23 criminal history points?
Well, I'd have to – it could be that my math is wrong, Your Honor. That is possible. He ended up in a range that would – or his range would have had to have been 41 to 51 months to end up where he's at. For 7 levels, it's 3 levels per. And so 21 – he was 1 point up in the level he was in, and that's how I got to – it was 7 levels and 20 criminal history points. If he's at the bottom, it would take 21 criminal history points to go 7
levels.
Well,
it's one offense level for every
– 3 points.
3 points above 13.
Yes, Your Honor. And he started off, though, at level 4. So he had 8 criminal history points, so it would have only taken him another – 5 criminal history points to get to level 13 criminal history points or level 6. Part of my extrapolation involved assigning a 3-point range to criminal history level 6. In other words, 13, 14, and 15 points would represent criminal history level 6 and then go up from there.
Now, your main complaint is that while we can go outside the what are now the guidelines that are not mandatory, that he didn't sufficiently detail why he went way above under 3553A?
No, Your Honor. I think that the judge sufficiently detailed why. I just think
so
that
you think it was just there's no way he can do this?
I think that is the case. Yes, Your Honor. It's not that he didn't detail his reasons. The reasons are detailed. And certainly I'm not claiming here that there is some procedural error in the judge addressing the various 3553A factors. In fact, I think he was very specific that his reason for departing, if you want to call it that, from the guidelines to the extent that he did, was that the criminal history calculation, as calculated, underrepresented the seriousness of his criminal history. So what we're arguing here is simply, okay, you can go up from the guidelines, and we'll even accept for the purposes of argument that would be reasonable to depart upward. And in guidelines parlance, an upward departure that would amount to 10 criminal history points, which would more than double what he already had.
Am I correct in thinking that the bottom line here would be that had this sentence been imposed before Booker, the degree of the departure would have been deemed unreasonable?
Correct.
Because the departure isn't adequately tied to the structure of the guidelines.
That's essentially the argument that we made in our initial brief. And I understand as well that even under the old system, it didn't have to be tied to the guidelines, though that was encouraged. An analogy to the guidelines used to be considered an acceptable way of evaluating the extent of departure, and I think in this particular case, it's still a useful means of evaluating the extent of the variance or departure or whatever you want to call it. And the reason is because we're talking about The judge's specific reason was criminal history.
Look, here the judge named the factors, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But isn't what's lacking an indication that the judge applied them to the facts in this case, except for criminal history?
Well, I think, you know, in our argument is that in weighing all of the factors, the application was inappropriate, because what ended up happening as a result of that application was an unduly severe sentence. So, yes, Your Honor, I think that is an accurate way of putting it. You know, one of the factors specifically that is at issue is avoiding undue sentencing disparities. And I think that is a factor that is off-cited now at the sentencing level for why we stick within the guidelines. I think that is something that this court had in mind in the Dean decision and the McDyuck decision, when it accorded a rebuttable presumption of reasonableness to the guidelines and stated in the Dean decision most recently that the more you deviate from the guidelines, the more explaining you have to do. And I know that's paraphrasing.
He cited the defendant's disrespect for the law.
I'm sorry, Aaron.
Didn't he explain that he recited the defendant's disregard for the law, not reentering once but twice?
Yes, Your Honor. And
assaulting women?
Yes, Your Honor. And if I'm going
to
go ahead and encroach.
Protect the public? That
absolutely.
The judge had to see. Well, aren't those all reasons?
Absolutely. And again, we would concede that this case, that a reasonable sentence in this case, it's not outside the realm of reason that a sentence in this case would exceed what the right recommended guideline level would be by as much as 10 criminal history points.
But the judge did give his reason.
He gave his reasons, but I don't think that's all that's required. I mean, there's the statute requires, A, that you consider the factors. And it also states specifically that you impose a sentence that takes into account the purposes of sentencing. So you can't just rely simply on the recitation of factors and stating that you consider.
Didn't the court ask them if they objected?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't the court ask if there was any objected at the time that he pronounced sentence?
No, Your Honor. There wasn't a specific question directed towards.
Did he ask the defense counsel if he had anything else to say?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
and what I, should he do? Give him a written invitation?
Well, Your Honor,
he's asking him to speak out. And if you have something to say, speak out now.
Your Honor, I think that is a fair point. But I would, and I think that this comes to the issue of whether or not the purpose here is what the standard of review should be. And I would suggest that in the situation present in this case, as well as many others now, where the sentencing guidelines have been rendered advisory, the terms of Rule 32H no longer apply. These are protections that were in place to ensure that a defendant had adequate notice to address the issues that the court was going to raise in deviating from the guidelines. We
you
don't have
tell
those.
Tell him in advance what he's going to ask him, is what you're saying.
Well, those are the protections that were
How
in place.
How do you know before you try the case what the problems are going to be?
Well, those are the protections that are in place, and the reason is that you do know, and the reason you would have known in the past and still know is you've got a PSR sitting in front of you. And Rule 32H would provide, or used to provide, that protection. It gave us adequate notice to address these issues.
And the court asked you, do you have anything else to say now that I pass in? There was no reply. It's waived.
I think that, in fairness, it shouldn't be reviewed as being waived. It still should be reviewed for reasonableness. The court as well.
It is reasonable. That's what we're saying. And he's asking him, if it isn't reasonable, tell me why.
Well, Your Honor, I think that putting a defendant in a position after a recitation of immediately adducing and suggesting to the court all of the reasons puts an unfair burden on the defendant that Rule 32H was designed to address and no longer addresses. And in this case as well, you had a sentencing memorandum that came after sentencing. There's no opportunity to address that either.
You understand, I know, Mr. Williams, that this is a case of first impression. In other words, whether or not, you know, a defendant is required to object on reasonableness grounds.
Yes, Your Honor.
In order to obtain reasonableness review.
And Your Honor, I think that within the case law that we've seen thus far, the Supreme Court suggestion in look and see if there's Sixth Amendment violations, then you give it reasonableness review. There's nothing in there to suggest that you need to recite specific buzzwords, and I don't think that requirement should be imposed. It's unfair. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Garrison.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Bob Garrison. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of Illinois, and I represented the government at the sentencing hearing, which is before the Court. I want to briefly address two issues, both of which have been touched on earlier in your questions to Mr. Williams. First of all, concerning the standard of review in this case, the defendant was not standing before the court without benefit of counsel. He had, of course, an attorney standing right there. I take objection to the fact that he had no opportunity to challenge reasonableness for these reasons. First of all, how difficult would it be for a defense counsel to say to the court, Your Honor, since the sentence is in excess of the anticipated guideline sentence range, I'm going to object and ask permission of the court to file written objections later.
Well, then, forgive me, but, you know, this court grants reasonableness review even in cases where no Booker objection was made in the first place, much less a reasonableness objection. Wouldn't it be inconsistent to require defendants who did not waive their Booker objection to lodge an extra objection to reasonableness when we've given reasonableness review to defendants who failed to raise any Booker objection at all?
Well, again, Your Honor, I can
only... And secondly, here, forgive me, but, you know, I'll get it all out, and then I'll calm down. But secondly, the court gave no advance warning in this case that it intended to depart from the guidelines before it did so. And in the pre-Booker scheme, judges who intended to depart from the guidelines were required to notify defendants ahead of time. It gave a defendant a reasonable opportunity to formulate and register objections to the departure. So what we have here is a judge taking a defendant by total surprise at sentencing, and you know, there's no good reason, in my mind at any rate, to find that a perfunctory anything else from a judge gives counsel any kind of adequate opportunity to comprehend what just happened and formulate and register a meaningful objection.
Well, Your Honor, as you said in your question to my colleague, Mr. Williams, a moment ago, it's a case of first impression. And quite frankly, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook has observed at different oral arguments that I've attended that by definition 50% of all lawyers are below average. I cannot believe that any lawyer looking at that pre-sentence report wouldn't have been on notice that someone with this kind of incredible criminal history, and history as being a scofflaw of the immigration laws, wouldn't be at some danger of being sentenced outside the guideline range. I would also suggest that, and in this I am in direct opposition to a factual point Mr. Williams made. He said the lawyer, the defense counsel at sentencing, who, by the way, was not Mr. Williams, had no opportunity to examine the reasonableness reasons given by the judge. I don't believe that's accurate. I have compared the transcript of the sentence hearing where the judge spoke, basically pages 10 and 11 of the sentencing transcript, with the sentence memorandum the judge prepared after the hearing, and they are virtually identical, so that everything in the memo, the sentencing memorandum, is set out by the court in person at the sentencing hearing.
But you see, Mr. Garrison, what you're not responding to is what I just explained, that pre-Booker, a judge who intended to depart was required to notify a defendant. Required. And why should it be any different now?
Well, I don't disagree with your contention that before Booker it was required. There is no case law requiring it now, and I take it, Your Honor, that's why you said it was a case of first impression.
Well, only partially, but...
This sentencing occurred just 3 or 4 days after Booker, wasn't it?
It was shortly thereafter, Your Honor.
Real close. I mean, we didn't have Palladino, for example.
No, sir.
And some other things that, if we knew then what we know now, maybe we'd do things differently. That concerns me a little. And also, as far as the specificity under 3553A of attributing. So I look at the bottom line and say 4 years, you know, that's not huge. And this guy, I think it was three times, didn't he come in?
Yes, yeah, three.
Three times.
It was once and then two times an additional after he'd been convicted of the felony for a total of three.
Yeah, and the judge is concerned that he's not getting the message that you're not welcome back as soon as we send you out. And it would seem that perhaps even under an adequate determinant of criminal conduct, for example, if the judge expounded on that in some detail and said, look, you are in a class by yourself. You just keep coming back, and then when you get here, you commit lots of crimes and do other things, not anything huge, but you just are a pretty bad guy, and therefore you're going to get an extraordinary sentence. Now, based on that, and it would seem if that were in some detail, but I see him sort of recite the standards and then go something else without tying them together, and I just wondered to what extent that would be necessary.
Well, Your Honor, we're talking here about a serial wife beater, and the judge specifically decides, both at the sentence hearing and in his sentencing memorandum, the factors of the deterrence of the defendant and the protection of the public from defendant's future crimes. Now, those are cited in both the sentence transcript and the sentence memorandum. You can quantify criminal history, I suppose, in the way that Mr. Williams has suggested, but how do you quantify deterrence of the defendant who has committed multiple crimes in the United States over a period of 15 or 20 years, and how do you quantify protecting the public from his likely future crimes?
Well, the problem is he's going to get shipped out, but he keeps coming back.
Yes.
Like it's a revolving door. And the only way you keep him from coming back is to keep him here.
Well, Your Honor, I agree, ironic though it may be. But in addition, Your Honor, the record before the court reflects that by the defendant's own admission through counsel, the man has been here illegally continuously since 1992. That is called being a scofflaw with a capital S, even without regard to his criminal history.
Here's the problem, and it is a problem. Believe me, I wish we could make bad law because of bad people at times, but we can't make bad law because of bad people.
I suppose that would require me to suggest or agree with the court that it's bad law, and of course I do not either in my written submissions or in my oral presentation. I think that this sentence was appropriate and that if ever a message needed to be sent, it was in this case, and that the court made an exemplary record going through 1835-53.
But never tying it together.
Well, that would be one interpretation, Your Honor. It seems to me that it was tied together extensively, both at the sentence hearing and in the memorandum, that he cited multiple factors, only one of which was the criminal history. And again, to me, the two most important factors, those being deterrence of the defendant and protection of the public, inherently are not quantifiable, but are certainly appropriate and indeed mandated to be considered under 18 U.S.C. Section 3553. Unless there are further questions from the court, that will conclude my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is his time expired?
Yes.
Okay, I guess we're all done. This case will be taken under advisement.